This is why you see, getting back to your points about the Gulf states and as we talk about the Europeans and other nations, a lack of trust, a lack of confidence in the United States. This is why nations are making a decision to leave the American order, right? To embrace this multipolar world. I mean, essentially, we're looking at this reality starkly there of the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz being closed, not even being able to put our ships into the Gulf of Oman, because we are trying to fight this war in a 20th century manner, and we're up against a 21st century adversary. So again, you're seeing this the end of one age and the beginning of another here.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. President Trump addressed the nation on Wednesday, in which he made a couple of very specific comments related to the Iran war. He said that we're winning, and it'll be over in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But he expressed great anger at NATO for not participating. Why? Well, because we're not winning. And he's upset that NATO hasn't jumped in to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians have closed. The president also said that Europe had two choices. They could jump in and take their oil by forcing open the Strait of Hormuz, or they could just buy their oil and gas from the United States, because he said disingenuously and wrongly that the United States is the greatest producer of oil and gas in the world. That's not true. In any event, he closed his speech by saying that if the Iranians don't reopen the Strait of Hormuz in the next 2 or 3 weeks, that he's going to begin attacking Iranian infrastructure, including the electrical grid. That's quite literally the definition of a war crime. You're not allowed to attack infrastructure. International law says so. International law to which the United States is a signatory. So where do we stand? Well, we're in a war that we're not winning. We're in a war without an exit strategy. And there was a slight change in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's rhetoric last week, where a reporter said something about the American-Israeli war against Iran. And he said, it's not an American-Israeli war against Iran. It's the American war against Iran, and Israel is America's ally. That's not the way I remember this thing starting. Well, we're going to talk about all this with our dear friend, Matthew Ho. I've known Matthew for many years. Matthew is a former State Department Foreign Service officer who resigned from the State Department in protest over American escalation of war in Afghanistan. Prior to his assignment in Afghanistan, Matthew took part in the American occupation of Iraq, first in 2004 and 2005 in Salah Hadin province, with the State Department Reconstruction and Governance Team, and then again in 2006 and 7 in Anbar province as a Marine Corps company commander. When not deployed, Matthew worked on Afghanistan and Iraq war policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and the State Department from 2002 to 2005. He has become one of the country's most important, most prominent, most vocal whistleblowers on America's misguided policy in the Middle East and Central Asia. Matthew's writings have appeared in such periodicals as the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, CNN, The Guardian, The Huffington Post, USA Today, and elsewhere. And in 2010, he was named the Ridenour Prize recipient for truth-telling. In 2021, he was awarded as a Defender of Liberty by the Committee for the Republic here in Washington, D.C. Matthew, welcome back, buddy.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me back on. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. I got to tell you, I was beside myself watching the president's speech to the American people last night. Now, interestingly enough, it appeared to be scripted. Did he wing it? Did he write it? Or do people in the White House really believe the things that came out of the president's mouth?
Yeah, I wonder about this all the time, because you see, when he's making speeches, he'll say things that nobody in their right mind would ever put down on paper, right? And particularly when he goes off the cuff, he's just goes on his tangents. But I think he probably has a team around him, one that are so sympathetic, so loyal to him, in lockstep with him, but also to know him so well right now that they know what he wants to say. They understand what he's trying to communicate. And of course, that communication is not based upon any sense of achievable policy, you know, any rational argument, any facts. Right. It's based upon improving the president's or demonstrating the president's role, his persona, projecting his ego. Right. I mean, and that's what we saw last night. We see this, just see these mishmashes. We see these contradictions constantly, but you see this bravado and this boasting that's just not rooted in anything. And yeah, we're in a lot of trouble here, John. You know, we are, in an empire that has been waging these wars, that has been bankrupting our people, taking investments that are needed in our communities and giving them the corporations and to crooked dictatorships overseas. And we're essentially in an empire that has a mad emperor in charge, and we're in a lot of trouble.
Matthew, I've been saying for many weeks that to win, the United States and Israel would have to overthrow the Iranian government, install a pro-US, pro-Israel government in the what is now the Islamic Republic, something that will never, ever, ever happen, and then somehow manage an exit strategy. And I'm unaware of any exit strategy that exists. For the Iranians to win, they just have to survive. And they've survived for 5,000 years. So is this a conflict that's winnable by American standards?
Well, there's an alternative for the Americans to win. That the way the Americans and the Israelis look at this, it's to turn Iran into Syria, turn Iran into a failed mm-hmm. state, dissolve Iran via civil war. So I think there is this belief that if we can't get regime change, the next best thing is to make it so that Iran is simply no longer a factor in the Middle East. It's so consumed with Iranians killing Iranians, and whether the government still stands or not, whether it resembles Syria or resembles Libya, is of not really great consequence to us, because the main thing is that we've taken Iran off the chessboard, if you will, that they're no longer a factor, and that if the Iranians are consumed with trying to maintain power or killing other Iranians or just staying alive, then they can't support Hezbollah, they can't support Ansar Allah, they can't support the Iraqi resistance, they can't provide any support for Palestinian resistance. And I certainly, you made that comment about Netanyahu saying this is America's war, and I think Netanyahu is communicating there the way the Israelis do view this, in the sense that this war on Iran is a supporting effort to their own efforts for regional hegemony, but also the expansion, the establishment of greater Israel. So, you know, the way I look at this is when you back all this out, when you understand it from the Israeli perspective, removing Iran by an American war on Iran allows an annexation of the West Bank to occur, right? So you have to do all these steps. You have to prepare. You have to take out any support whatsoever, whether it's military, financial, moral, political, diplomatic, that the Palestinians could have. And so that's how I also see in this emphasis on Lebanon, of course. Now, Lebanon, of course, also falls into that idea or that dream of greater Israel. But for the Israelis, the West Bank has been the goal for decades. And so when you quote Netanyahu there, it does remind me that for the Israelis, Iran is not the main effort. It's a supporting effort for them to be able to eventually annex the West Bank.
Before I ask you the next question, I want to mention a word from one of our sponsors. Last week, the Treasury Department put out its financial report for 2025. Almost no one covered it. Here's what it said: $6 trillion in assets, $47 trillion in debt. The U.S. government is $41 trillion in debt. That's not my opinion. That's the Treasury Department's own numbers. A few days ago, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said the debt path quote, will not end well, unquote. Those are his words. Meanwhile, the big, beautiful bill just added $3 trillion more in debt, and we're paying over $1 trillion a year in interest on the national debt. I spent 14 years in the CIA. I learned to spot problems before they blow up. Right now, central banks all over the world are buying gold as fast as they can. China, Poland, India, they all see what's coming. Well, we have a free report with American Alternative Assets called The Big Beautiful Bubble. It shows what's really going on and how to protect your savings, your assets before things get worse. Go to johnlovesgold.com for your free copy. That's johnlovesgold.com or call 1-888-GOLD-053. Matthew, I've said this a million times, but I'm going to say it again. Every Israeli prime minister from the mid-1980s who came to the United States to see every American president since Ronald Reagan would say, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran. And every president said, I'm not going to bomb Iran for you until this one. Well, we learned a couple of weeks ago that Benjamin Netanyahu came to see both Joe Biden and before him, Barack Obama, and said, if you don't bomb Iran, we're going to do it and we're going to use nukes. And both Obama and Biden said, go ahead and do it. They called his bluff. And of course, he didn't do it. He apparently threatened Donald Trump with the same thing. Bomb Iran or we're going to use nukes. And Trump said, okay, I'll bomb Iran. Just don't use the nukes. How did we get suckered into this? Was it really that easy just to tell Donald Trump, we're going to use nukes if you don't bomb Iran? And the next thing we know, we're at war with one of the strongest, most populous, and most important countries in the Middle East?
Well, you rightly point out, John, that it took Donald Trump as president to agree to this war, that previous presidents have been pressured on it and they'd all avoided it. George W. Bush seemed to have come close, but you know they smartly didn't do it. And for me, there's a lot of reasons for this war. Certainly the Israelis, you know, they're assemble everybody in a room who's responsible for this. And the Israelis are sitting in the front seats, you know, but there's also other actors, other institutions here, other interests, the military industrial complex, fossil fuel industry, you know, the tech companies, they see Iran as a place where 92 million people are not on Facebook or Instagram or X, right? So there's a American commercial interests that see a marketplace available to them. But for me, all of those are just manifestations of the American empire. For me, this really comes back to, this is what empires do, that, you know, the United States taking over from the British Empire in the Middle East assumes what Britain was trying to achieve there, what their imperial objectives were. I mean, you go back to the idea of the colonization of Palestine, endorsed by the British, you know, propelled by the British to the Balfour Declaration. And then you have Ronald Storrs, who's one of Britain's governor generals in Palestine, you know, saying in the 20s, what we're doing here is we're establishing a loyal Jewish Ulster in the midst of a potentially hostile sea of Arabs. I mean, so you see the imperial purposes of this colony, this Western colony in the Middle East. And then, you know, as the United States takes over from the British, certainly through the Eisenhower and Kennedy years, there are difficulties with Iran, with conflicts on interests. But then when you get to the Nixon years, you have the establishment of the Nixon Doctrine and Richard Nixon seeing the Israelis in the West and then the Iranians under the Shah in the East as being the cops on the beat in the Middle East. And the idea being to contain Arabism, that we're going to use Jewish Israel and Persian Iran to contain the Sunni Arabs, right? Because particularly in the 60s and 70s, the threat of pan-Arabism was of grave concern to the American empire. Then develops further. You get into the 80s, you have the establishment of modern Hasbara, you know, particularly after Ronald Reagan rebukes Israel, Menachem Begin, following Israel's brutal invasion of Lebanon. The Israelis recognize that we need to have more control in the situation. And now you have this other aspect of the United States. It's certainly an empire, but it also is a government of legalized bribery. And the Israelis, just like so many other industries, institutions, interests, et cetera, have recognized that. And they have been successful in essentially, you know, basically my opinion is the American empire has sold off its organs for the highest bidder. And so Middle East foreign policy has gone to the Israelis. They bid the most. They paid the most for it. You know, just like our healthcare policies, just like our agricultural policies, right? Just like you name it, in the sense of how does our government decide policy, whether it's domestic or foreign, it goes to the highest bidder, essentially. And so that's how I see the evolution of this. And that's how I see you getting to a point then where you have this inertia, whether it's an imperial inertia, because again, you have this country, Iran, that has to be repudiated, has to be punished for 1979. It's also standing up against the hegemon. It's standing, it's sticking up and giving a finger, right, to the empire. You can't allow that. It's supporting other groups that are doing the same. It's ruining our ambitions for dominance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand as well, then you have this capture of American Middle Eastern policy by the Israel lobby. And so the two things finally culminate in Donald Trump's presidency, because now you have a president who's malleable enough, who's foolish enough, who's ahistoric enough, however you want to describe him, to go along with this. And I that to me is how we've arrived in this absolutely ridiculous and stupid war. Also to say it's illegal, it's going to be counterproductive, right. It's immoral, right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Matthew, I've got to ask you, I'm a frequent visitor to the Persian Gulf. I spent the better part of my career there, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. I go to the United Arab Emirates relatively regularly. And it seems like the governments of those countries are of two minds, or three minds. Number one, they dislike, in some cases, they hate Iran, and they distrust Iran. They fear Iran at the same time. But they know that it's a rough neighborhood, and they have to live in it. Okay. Number two, the Saudis spent 10 years trying to finally normalize relations with Iran. They did that. Behind the scenes, we're hearing that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, maybe even the Kuwaitis have been urging the United States to go for it, overthrow this government, and let the chips fall. At the same time, there is a significant U.S. Army presence in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, in the Emirates, and in Oman. The headquarters of the Fifth Fleet is in Bahrain. And the U.S. Air Force has the world's largest airbase at Al Udeid in Qatar. Having all this American military presence is supposed to protect these countries from Iran. And it hasn't. The Iranians have been able to use these cheap, domestically built drones, suicide drones, packed with explosives, fly them into hotels, blow up the runways of the airports in Kuwait and Bahrain, blow up fuel storage tanks at Dubai airport, and essentially scare the daylights out of everybody. So on the one hand, do these countries really want this war to continue and for the U.S. to overthrow the Iranian government? Or do they want the war to end so life can go back to normal and everybody can start making money again? Or are they going to have to question the wisdom of the U.S. military presence? If the U.S. can't protect them, why be there in the first place? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's a great analysis, John. I'd add too that these countries don't like each other. Certainly the conflict between the Saudis and the Emiratis, very clear in the last year, you know, the Saudis militarily evicting the Emiratis from Yemen. It was just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, you had the other Gulf states blockading Qatar. And that looked like that was going to turn into a war. So you have these tensions, these conflicts, this lack of trust, if you will, between these countries themselves. So I think for many years, the American presence, them all being vassals in the American empire, had a stabilizing effect. Your point, though, is that the Iranians have demonstrated to the region that these bases, this American presence, doesn't make you safer. It makes you a target. That the guarantee of security from the Americans was false. It was hollow. And just as the general agreement that the United States had with the world, essentially, following the Second World War, that the United States would guarantee the freedom of movement of critical energy supplies out of the Middle East, was what the United States was giving the world in exchange for its dominance, right? You let us lead, essentially, and we will provide these benefits to you. And that has turned out to be a farce as well. And again, you know, certainly people watching, listening are all saying, yeah, this is what happens when you have a declining empire. You know, this, you know, the Iranians are just poking holes and showing us what we all know, how corrupted, how faded, how dysfunctional it was under the facade. But this question that you're asking, what should the Gulf states be doing? Well, one, I think these Gulf states recognize that they owe their positions, say particularly the monarch in Manama, the ruling family in Bahrain. They owe their positions to the American presence, right? I mean, and certainly the other families in the region, you know, more secure, but they also recognize that the good thing they have going is because of their relationship with the United States. But that's juxtaposed now up against the reality that the United States not just can't protect them, but won't protect them. You know, in this hierarchy of states within the empire, they are far below Israel. There's Israel and then there's everybody else. The Ukrainians have learned this out. I mean, I probably said this to you. We've talked about Ukraine. The Ukraine was going to be the next Afghanistan, right, in terms of how we were going to treat allies. And now we're seeing this with the Gulf states. So, you know, this determination of what the Gulf states want to do is of course tainted by the fact that you have these corrupt monarchs in power who see that their power has been based in the presence of the United States. So why are they going to give that up? But they are staring into the stark reality of the jeopardy of maintaining this relationship with the United States. I mean, the harm that's come to them already and that will continue to come if this war goes on. And I'm not certain why anyone would be in favor of extending this war, because continuing as the more the war goes on, the more it's in Iran's favor. But, you know, certainly, you know, they have their, I'm assuming they have their machinations, how they see a shattered, dysfunctional Iran spewing millions of refugees through the region, permanently closing the Straits of Hormuz is somehow in their favor. I don't really understand. But again, these men owe their positions to the presence of the United States. And I think just as you see with the Europeans wanting to hold on to NATO, wanting to hold on to something that has put them in power, kept them in power, wanting to keep the status quo. But this, you know, gets to the point then, John, that this war to me is going to be a radically transformative event in history, that this will be the event that the historians say, this is when the American century ends, this is when the 20th century ends, and this is where the multipolar world begins, this is where the 21st century begins. Now, of course, you know, we're already in the multipolar world, but historians like to have something to mark, you know, as a start date in history. And I think this could be very much that.
I want to ask you one more question about the Strait of Hormuz before we move on to other issues. I do want to talk about NATO and Lebanon as well. But, you know, back in the 1980s, Matthew, there was a conflict between, well, Iran and the United States, Iran and the Arab Gulf states. And the Reagan administration responded by putting American flags on oil tankers carrying Kuwaiti oil and escorting them with the U.S. Navy, escorting them through the Strait of Hormuz. Right now, the Strait of Hormuz is effectively closed. One ship got through last week, and it was an Indian flag tanker carrying oil to China, and the Indian ship paid a toll to the Iranian government. The Iranians allowed them to go through unmolested. Besides that, 65% of the world's fertilizer goes through the Strait of Hormuz. We're going to get to the point where we're going to go into a global food crisis if fertilizer can't make its way through the Strait. Do you see the U.S. Navy escorting ships? Do you see the U.S. government reflagging tankers or cargo ships? Do you see the U.S. Navy attacking the Iranians more ferociously and trying to take control of the Strait of Hormuz? How does this end up working out?
You know, in the 80s, when we reflagged those tankers and escorted them, we had a much more capable Navy, a larger Navy, of course, yeah. but also yeah. one that was able to actually have a presence in the Persian Gulf. Our Navy is 1,000 kilometers away from the Straits of Hormuz right now. We can't get any closer right. than that. I mean, so just one is just a difference in warfare, what's available to adversaries now in terms of missiles and drones and satellite tracking and things like that. But, you know, the reality, too, that you have a superficiality here with the American military. You have a hollowed out, vapid force. You have a defense industry that for years can't produce ships or planes that aren't maintenance nightmares. You have a Navy that we can't even put all our ships underway because we simply don't have enough sailors to man them. As well, then, too, you see the Gerald Ford, the $13 billion aircraft carrier, the newest and most expensive and largest warship ever built. And she's in port now because of a laundry fire. I mean, there's so many. We could have a whole conversation just unwrapping that. Where's the damage control? Why every sailor is supposed to be a firefighter? It took you guys 30 hours to put out a laundry room fire, right? I mean, so, you know, that story itself. Well, the toilets didn't work, and the toilets never worked on that ship. So, but it gets to the point that we have a Navy that for $13 billion, you know, damage control is what they're supposed to build those ships around. That's the idea of a warship, supposed to be able to survive contact, survive damage. So they build these warships with damage control as something that they build around. And then again, this idea that, you know, in the Marine Corps, every Marine's a rifleman, in the Navy, every sailor's a firefighter. And it took you 30 hours to put out this fire? You know, so it shows you again, the design, the construction, what our forces are actually equipped with. How just they're not built for warfare. The purpose of the military industrial complex is not to build warships that can protect American interests, is to make profits for weapons companies. And the same thing, too. You have a force that a personnel force, a combat force that can't do the rudimentary basic things that all sailors, all navies have required since the dawn of navies, since the first naval ship took to sail, you know? So, I mean, I think in that it gets to what you're talking about here, about the impossibility of this, the impracticability of this, the fantasy of the United States forcing its way through the Straits of Hormuz, and the fact that all this information was knowledgeable. All this was mm-hmm. understood. Nothing occurred in the last 4 weeks that made this any different than the previous 4 weeks were in terms of the actual capacity and capabilities and readiness and abilities of the American military. So you have an American military that can't meet the objectives of the U.S. president. Now, it's an objective that the president caused by his disastrous choice to launch a war of aggression. But still, the American military cannot achieve the objectives of the president. And I think, you know, again, we could start talking again about decline of the American empire and everything. But this is a real aspect of that. And this is why you see, getting back to your points about the Gulf states and as we talk about the Europeans and other nations, a lack of trust, a lack of confidence in the United States. This is why nations are making a decision to leave the American order, right? To embrace this multipolar world. I mean, essentially, we're looking at this reality starkly there of the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz being closed, not even being able to put our ships into the Gulf of Oman, because we are trying to fight this war in a 20th century manner, and we're up against a 21st yes. century adversary. So again, you're seeing this the end of one age and the beginning of another here.
You're 100% right about that. The nature of warfare has changed, and it's like it just hasn't occurred to us yet. But before we get to NATO, because I have some specific
it's occurred to you and I, and it's occurred to these people are smart enough to know it, but they know that changing the status quo means they lose their business model, right? And whether the business model is a policy-based business model, whether it's a campaign donation-based business model, whether it's military industrial. I remember, John, working in procurement during the Iraq war, trying to find technologies to find suicide bombers, going to a meeting, and there are all these executives from these defense companies there. and waiting to go into the meeting and hearing these executives talking in the passageway in the hallway and, you know, saying essentially, I can't wait for this war to be over so we can go back to business, right? Business as usual, right? I mean, that's the mindset there. Business as usual. Yeah.
Before we go to NATO, I have to ask you about Lebanon. This most recent Israeli invasion of Lebanon has been particularly brutal. The Israelis appear to be in the process of creating what looks like a safe zone, a no man's land south of the Litani River. And there are 900,000 internally displaced civilians. Lebanon's already a failed state for a whole bunch of reasons, but this just makes it worse. It's a level of human misery that is almost unparalleled in the Middle East right now, although I guess you could draw comparisons with Yemen. Is there any upside to any of this? Is there any good news for the Lebanese? Is there any way to get out of this? Or are we going to see the continued slow motion destruction of Lebanon as a country?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I hate to say that, but I just don't see the Israelis pulling back from their objectives here. Again, this objective of Lebanon, and certainly you go back to the early Zionists, they spoke of how Israel should go to the Litani River, you know, so 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers or so into Lebanon. I just don't see the Israelis backing away from this. This is, and many of Israelis have said this, October 7th gave them the best chance they're ever going to have, and they're going to capitalize on it. They're going to take advantage of this moment. They finally had an American president who would attack Iran, who would do this work that they need done in order to now carry out these other aspects of greater Israel. They've neutralized Syria by helping to get an Al-Qaeda boss. You know, that's a whole conversation we can have there. I know that upsets you as much as it upsets me, right? You know, I shouldn't get us started on that. But, you know, but with the Lebanese, I think with the Lebanese, though, it is. They are in this position where who's going to remove the Israelis? The Israelis just killed 3 UN peacekeepers the other day. They don't care. I mean, what's going to force the Israelis out of it? Even if Donald Trump was to end the war tomorrow in Iran, the Israelis are not pulling out of Lebanon. I think this time, this presence there is going to be permanent. It will look, I think, like a no man's land, as you described it. I know there are Israeli settlers who are trying to get in. But again, for me, the purposes for the Israelis are to create that buffer zone. I mean, again, and many do want the Greater Israel Project there as well. But the idea of having this buffer zone, that their flank, their northern flank, is secure, so that when they focus on fully annexing the West Bank, which is a project that's already underway, they won't have to provide too much attention to Lebanon. You know, again, a supporting effort the same way, too. Hopefully the Israelis are thinking by the time Trump lets up, Iran will be, if it's still standing and it's not in a civil war, then at least it'll be in a place where it can't really provide much support. It can't really affect our operations in the West Bank. It can't fire missiles and drones at us, or it would choose not to do so because it's been deterred by our war on them. So yeah, with regards to the Lebanese, I really wish I had something other to say, but I don't see, in the same for the Palestinians, I don't see where the help is going to come from.
Yeah. Just as an aside, I had dinner a couple of weeks ago with a senior Turkish government official. And we were talking about Syria, and I said about President Ahmed Ajarra, I said, he has to be a CIA asset, right? I mean, how can you be a senior Al-Qaeda figure, the deputy founder of ISIS, and then the U.S. supports your ascension to the presidency of Syria? He has to be CIA. And the Turk said, oh, no, he's ours. We put him in there. And I said, you know what? That actually makes perfect sense.
It does
Matthew,
make sense.
I got to ask you.
Yeah. I do want to upset everybody by reminding them of the conversation that he had with David Petraeus, though, last September, where Petraeus, the former CIA director, did say to him, your success is our success. So just to upset
there
anybody
right
whose
there.
Day wasn't going well, remember that. Yeah.
That's exactly right. In the meantime, Druze and Christians are being literally massacred. Quite literally, right, which is exactly what you and I said was going to happen. You know, whether you like Bashar al-Assad or not, whether you like his politics or not, he was the only thing standing between minority communities and complete annihilation. And that's what's happened.
Right.
So let me ask you about NATO. Donald Trump said last night that he is, his words, absolutely considering withdrawing from NATO. He's not going to withdraw from NATO. But the fact that he would just speak those words weakens the alliance. We also learned last week that in the midst of this bizarro world claim to Greenland, the Danish military quietly and literally in the middle of the night sent plane loads of explosives to Greenland to blow up their own airport runways to try to at least temporarily forestall what they believed might be an American invasion. This is Denmark. We're talking about invading Denmark. Has enough damage been done to the alliance that NATO has done? Do you think the United States will withdraw? Even if it doesn't withdraw, can NATO survive this administration?
I think, who knows what Donald Trump is going to do, right? And it's so certainly is a possibility that he would try and withdraw the United States from NATO. It requires an act of Congress to do that. That's not going to happen.
Yes.
Right. So now you'd have a reduced relationship as long as Trump is in the White House. And I think what the Europeans are counting on is for the Democrats to take control of the White House in 28. I think for many of those in power throughout Europe, again, they are the same mindset. They are living in the 20th century, and NATO is a 20th century structure. NATO is not suited for the 21st century, but structures like NATO are what keep people like Starmer and Mertz and Macron and von der Leyen in power, right? Kala Kallas, who is, I believe, who is the foreign minister of the EU, is must go to bed at night thinking about becoming or replacing Ursula von der Leyen as the head of the EU. And then, of course, in Kallas's mind, if you're paying attention to what she says, the idea for Kallas may be then, and here I'm speculating, but okay, if we lose NATO, then we'll get our EU army. So again, here's another aspect of this where you see this transformative effect of this war, this splintering of Europe. Look, the Iraq war in 2003 was incredibly unpopular. But the British sent 45,000 troops to take part in the invasion. The Spanish and the Italians that just closed airspace for the U.S. With this war had thousands of troops in the Iraq war. And now you're seeing this type of, there's a spectrum, of course, on where the Europeans are, Spain and Italy on one side. But even like the Germans, even Friedrich Merz, who last year declared that the Israelis were doing our dirty work with Iran. And certainly Merz and Starmer and Macron and their governments have as much to blame for this situation because they went along with the disbandment of the JCPOA. They were the ones who pushed the snapback sanctions into effect in the fall. That was the precipitate cause of the collapse of the Iranian economy, the collapse of the Iranian rial last winter, right? I mean, like all these things the Europeans have their hands in as well, but they recognize that this war is just too much. I mean, my God, if the Iraq war wasn't too much for them, but this war is too much for them, it shows, one, just how much of a folly this war is, too, but just how much things have changed. So the Europeans in power want to hold on to NATO because they believe that those type of structures that keep us in power, they want the status quo. They've got their fingers crossed that Gavin Newsom or Gretchen Whitmer or AOC or somebody takes the White House in 28 and things can go back to normal and the Europeans can be the junior partners in the American empire. Others, I think, are looking at a sense of, okay, if we lose NATO, here's an opportunity for Europe to now come into the multipolar world as its own confederation, as its own bloc, as its own organism, however you want to describe it. I think anyone who's thinking that way would be like a Kallas who sees it for her own ambitions. But for the most part, those who are ruling in power right now look at NATO as one of those structures that is a good thing. It keeps them in power. It is the infrastructure upon which they sit. So again, looking backwards to the 20th century, and that's one of the reasons why Europe is in the condition it's in. You know, Europe has had a really, why, John, following the end of the Cold War, the Europeans didn't go on their own way. If they had, we can imagine now a Europe that is a global hub of technology, right? A global hub for education, you know, what have you. Instead, the Europeans went along with our wars. They took part in our wars. They embraced our neoliberal fantasies for their economics, right? And now they are countries, by and large, that are hollowed out, whose people are dealing with housing problems, healthcare problems, cost of life issues, as well then, too, issues regarding immigration. I mean, you name it, the Europeans are struggling with it right now. And their mindset, this goes back to this conversation about NATO, looking back to the past, being in the 20th century, their mindset is that we're going to embrace a military Keynesianism, and that will get us out of this. Politically, our identity, particularly with the Russian wars, depended upon it. That's what we're going to use to distract our population, foreign wars, foreign menaces, right? So a political Keynesianism, if you will, through militarization. But then also, too, the main thing is we're going to get our economies out of this through a Keynesianism, but we're going to invest all this money. We're going to practice austerity. We're going to further take from our people, further deny real investments that return something to our people. And we're going to put that money into our weapons industries. And I think everybody knows exactly how that's going to go.
Before we move on to Palestine, another word from one of our sponsors. If there's one thing that we've learned over the last few years, it is that access to medication can change quickly depending on politics, regulation, and corporate influence. That is why it's important to have a pharmacy that focuses on access and transparency, not on bureaucracy. And that's the reason why people are turning to All Family Pharmacy. Instead of scheduling doctor visits, sitting in waiting rooms, and dealing with insurance approvals, the entire process is handled online. You choose the medications you need on their website, you fill out a short medical form, and a licensed doctor reviews your request. If it's appropriate, they provide the prescription, and then they ship directly to your door. It's a simple way to keep essential medications on hand like antibiotics, antivirals, ivermectin, mebendazole, NAD+, and more than 400 other prescription medications people rely on every day. Prepare now before you need it in the future. Visit allfamilypharmacy.com/John and use promo code JOHN10 to save 10% on your next order. So, Palestine, Matthew, we can't have a conversation like this without talking about Palestine. Gaza essentially has been destroyed. Hundreds of thousands of people are still on the move. There's not enough food. There's not enough water. There's not a single functioning hospital. There's no electricity, not enough medications. And the Israeli government won't let NGOs or even the American government provide relief. We had Anthony Aguilar on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he told an absolutely grim story about the situation on the ground in Gaza. So is Gaza done? Is Donald Trump going to get his wish of forcing out every Palestinian so he can, his words, make it better than Monte Carlo? Is this a real estate play? And what does all this mean for the West Bank as the Israelis turn their attention there?
I think what we're looking at here is a population of the Palestinian population in Gaza living in now roughly 40%. Of what the Gaza Strip once was. The Israelis have taken approximately 60% of the Gaza Strip. I think there's going to be some tension as to whether that becomes Israeli settlements or Trump high rises, right? So whether we see settler caravans or Trump casinos, we'll see. But certainly, you know, it gets back to this idea we're talking about with Lebanon. Who's going to get them out? Who's going to force the Israelis or the Americans? And that the cruel thing about Gaza and this, well, the 2 million people in Gaza, there's 2 million cruel things occurring every day. But this reality that this Board of Peace, this plan for Gaza, this structure that has been put in place is international law. I mean, this betrayal of the Palestinian people by the international community, by enshrining Donald Trump's Board of Peace as an act of the UN Security Council, which makes it international law. I mean, what's to be done? What's to be done about this? And so I think the Palestinians are going to suffer and will continue to suffer. And the conditions, the plan is to make it so horrible and to slowly let some out that eventually you get to a point where they start dying off, not too quickly to attract the world's attention, but, you know, enough so that the pressure is there so that eventually Egypt will let them in, or some cruise ship will come along and pick them up and take them to some country the United States has bribed to allow them there. You know, and this is a project that's been going on. It goes back to the Biden administration, finding some place for the Palestinians to go to. You know, the Biden administration had money set aside to build tent camps in the Sinai, for a tent city in the Sinai for all of the Palestinians from Gaza, as well as understanding that the Israelis were running around the country, running around the world, trying to find somebody to take these people in. And so eventually the right bribe will be given to the right country, and that opportunity will be presented to the Palestinians. And some will take it because you're going to sit there and watch your children starve to death, you know, and others won't. But all of this then sets up the annexation of the West Bank. I mean, it's already there in our language, John. You and I don't do this, and the good folks watching and listening don't do this. But the way Palestine is discussed, it's already separate enclaves. It has been, you know, physically for years, but at least with our language, we always try to state Palestine. But now it's very difficult to get that point across that Gaza and the West Bank are the same land. And the Israelis and Americans have been very effective at cutting that. And, you know, the plan for the Israelis in the West Bank, and they have said this outright, is to essentially you have in the West Bank, under the Oslo Accords, the West Bank was divided into area A, B, and C. Area C, complete Israeli control. Area B, more village areas that were under mixed control, but basically most of the Israelis controlled it. And in area A were the large urban areas that were fully under control of the Palestinian Authority. Area C is fully controlled by the Israelis. Area B is being winnowed away every day. People are being driven out of the villages into the cities. And the idea basically is that you will have seven or eight urban areas that will continually be chiseled away. You know, thousands of homes will continually be demolished, but that these urban areas will be where the Palestinians are gathered into essentially concentration camps, and that they will be left to die on the vine there. They will not be able to support one another. They will be cut off from one another. Settlers will continue to fill the spaces between these urban areas, and that they will sometimes be reduced, particularly the places that the Israelis hate, like Jenin and Nablus. They will reduce those parts of those cities, but other places like Ramallah will be left to just die on the vine. And in other places like Hebron, where you have settlers already mixed into the city, you will see a greater fortification by the Israeli military within the city, and a greater persecution of the Palestinians living there. And so eventually, 10 years from now, you have essentially an annexed West Bank that has been taken over through Israeli ownership, both de facto and de jure. And you have these concentration camps that we once called cities, where the Palestinians are being immiserated, they're suffering, and they're slowly dying. And again, of course, hope that the good friend of the Israelis and the Americans, King Hussein, opens his borders or something like that. And that's how they get rid of the problem.
One last question for you, Matthew. The Democrats are widely projected to take the House of Representatives back in November in the midterm elections. The polls are showing as many as 40 seats possibly flipping. Those same polls show that the Democrats have a real chance of winning the U.S. Senate. If they win every close race, the Democrats could take the Senate 51-49. But does any of that matter in terms of policy toward Iran, toward Israel, toward Palestine, toward Lebanon?
No.
I didn't think so.
It will be similar, John, to what we saw when the Democrats took control of the Congress in 2006. And the Democrats felt that allowing the Iraq war to continue would better their chances to take the White House in 2008. And that's what you'll see here, too, as well. Plus, also, too, you have many members of the Democratic Party, particularly in the leadership positions, who believe in what the United States is doing, who believe in this Iran war. They temper their statements, or they try and speak out of both sides of their mouth because they understand how unpopular the war is, particularly within the Democratic Party. But certainly you see people, Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, you know, et cetera, who are supportive of this war. I don't see them doing anything if they come into power next January that limits the president's foreign policy, limits his wars. I think their triangulation, their calculus will be, how do we allow him to keep doing things that will give us a better chance to win the White House in 28? But these things are also what we believe in. I mean, this is why there are political consequences for war. We've seen it in 2006, yeah. 2008. We saw it in 2016. But that just changes the party in power. That just changes the color of the shirt of the person who's sitting in the seat. Doesn't change the imperial structure. It doesn't change the American empire. And, you know, you have two parties that are a uniparty when it comes to the imperial, you know, the imperial aspects of the United States. And so I think regardless of what happens in November, you don't have a change in the war machine or the war state, because that is the structure upon which everything is built.
Matthew Ho, thank you so much for being with us and for explaining these very complicated issues. I wish I could say that that I was optimistic about things, but like you, yeah. I'm really not. And I think that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on these issues. You know, when Benjamin Netanyahu comes to Washington, which he does quite frequently, and he goes up to Capitol Hill to see his friends, and Democratic senators are literally running through the hall, like O.J. Simpson through an airport in the old 70s commercial, so that they could get a photo op with Netanyahu before he leaves the building, you know we're in trouble.
Right. Well, they had the votes, according to Ryan Grimm and the folks at Drop Site News, and as well as at The Intercept, I believe. The Democrats had the votes in the House to pass a war powers resolution. It wouldn't have mattered because the Senate had rejected it, but still you'd have a votes on record on this. And Hakeem Jeffries and the Democratic Party leadership didn't have that vote. They decided to go on recess, on vacation. What's more important than voting on issues of war and peace for these members of Congress? It's obviously, one, not getting your name on record, not stopping this war, doing something to stop this war, but also, two, the more important thing is getting back home to your districts, shaking hands and collecting checks, right?
Isn't that the truth? Well, Matthew, thanks again for joining us. Always love talking to you, and thanks for setting us straight on some of these issues. Appreciate it very much. I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you, John.
All the best, buddy. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for another episode of Deep Focus. We can only continue to do this because of you. So thanks for watching. Thanks for liking, sharing, subscribing, and all that good stuff. Please keep it up. We'll see you next time.